Good morning at last, all the people who are listening live, and I know there's a fair number of you in the chat room. We're sorry that we're a little bit late, just been one sort of hiccup after another this morning, but finally we're here, second part of the Riddles in the Dark, quote-unquote, split special, and I don't want to waste too much of your time with the fancy beginning, so let's get right to it. My partner in crime, the Tolkien professor, is here with me, and I'm Dave Kale, and we'll be introducing a special guest shortly, as soon as his computer reboots. So, good morning, Corey.
Good morning. Okay, so today we are going to enter into the more speculative realm of the talk about where the films are going to be split and what's involved. As we were saying last week, to me, the biggest question, of course, it's an interesting question, and it's one of the primary ones, it seems to me, that most everybody is thinking about how they're going to be dividing the movies. And really, as I said, it's not just a question of that particular issue of the split, but the overall storytelling approach. What kind of story are they going to be telling in part one, and what kind of story are they going to be telling in part two, and how are they going to handle that? Well, as we said, last week we were focusing primarily on where that would happen in the Hobbit story, in the story of the journey of Bilbo and the dwarves. But, of course, as we know, there's a lot more behind that, and what is much more that is there's much more to the films than just that, as Peter Jackson and company have been incorporating all of this other stuff that that Tolkien worked into it, all the backstory that he developed. So so basically this is what we want to focus on today, which, as I say, is a great deal more speculative, because we know stuff that they're going to be sticking to. There's so much more for them to work with, obviously, in the fully developed Hobbit plot. The backstory stuff, we know some of the facts of what happened behind the scenes, where Gandalf goes and what happens and everything. But, of course, there's very little actual narrative given by Tolkien, which gives the film writers a lot more freedom, and therefore leaves us guessing a great deal more about how exactly they're going to do what Dave and I have been referring to as the whole White Council plot, and exactly how that's going to break down and the role that that's going to play in the two separate films. So I think it's probably best to start off with a kind of a quick review of what we do know, a quick review of the basic story that we are alluding to. Of course, in the Hobbit book, Gandalf leaves them before they enter Mirkwood, and he doesn't really say why. He just says he has some pressing business off to the south that he's already, you know, very late for through bothering with you people. And he goes off, and it seems actually relative. I mean, that based on the evidence, the odds are Tolkien himself had no idea what Gandalf was going to do. That was not really, I think, firmly developed in Tolkien's mind until a little bit later. At the end of The Hobbit, we learn where he went. Gandalf, of course, comes back just in time for the Battle of Five Armies. When he gets to Rivendell, excuse me, when he gets to Rivendell,
you all right in the there? Last,
yeah, I'm fine. I think I'll live. when he gets to Rivendell in the last chapter, he, we get a bit. Bilbo overhears him talking to Elrond and reporting back about what happened, and says that there was a meeting of the good wizards, and that they drove the necromancer out of Mirkwood. And this is sort of part of everything coming right at the end of The Hobbit. The goblins have been almost destroyed in the Misty Mountains. The kingdom has been reestablished in the mountain and dale, and now the necromancer too is gone out of Mirkwood. So Mirkwood is going to be Greenwood the Great again, and it's going to be merrier for a long time, and the elves are happy, and everybody's happy. So that's basically all we know at first. Now, when in the sequel, when as Tolkien is writing The Lord of the Rings, he goes through and starts to expand on the whole necromancer plot and who the necromancer is and what is going on there. Of course, this becomes a great deal more prominent, and we learn that the necromancer is, of course, Sauron himself taking shape again after his defeat at the end of the Second Age in the Battle of Dagor Laad. And he is he's just working to reestablish himself. And basically, one of the things that Tolkien does in Revision is that he, in a sense, reduces the significance of the significance of that conflict between the White Council and the Necromancer. No longer is this some kind of knockdown, drag-out wizard battle where the good guys won. Instead, we're told that the Necromancer was really Sauron, and he left Mirkwood when the White Council exerted itself against him, but he only feigned to flee, as Gandalf says. He was only pretending. He was really planning to set up in Mordor all along, and the time had come ripe for him to actually the time had come right for him to finally move back into his old digs in Mordor, and that's where he was going. So really, what seemed to be, or what was initially conceived to be, as some kind of a climactic battle wasn't really. And actually, this is just sort of a part of the move in the larger strategy of Sauron, who is establishing himself and preparing for the War of the Ring. So now that's kind of roughly what we have there. Now, of course, the other thing that we're told, which I am sure is going to be relevant to the film, is the role of Saruman in this. Saruman, of course, was the head of the White Council. Though Gandalf suspects later on that he had already started to go bad and was already laying his own plans, and we're told later on that Gandalf believes that the reason Saruman had decided to go along with the rest of the council who wanted to try to kick the necromancer out of Mirkwood, the reason Saruman went along with that is that he, Saruman, was still searching for the ring in the river Anduin near the Gladden Fields where Isildur lost it. And so he wanted Sauron out, basically. He thought it was to his advantage to pressure Sauron to leave southern Mirkwood so that he wouldn't be so close to the Gladden Fields, and that would give Saruman a clearer field for continuing to hunt for the ring. Of course, we know that the ring isn't there, and that that Deagle found it and Gollum took it into the Misty Mountains a long time ago, but Saruman doesn't know that. So that the way in which Saruman is himself plotting to try to open up his, you know, so this is part of a political move between Saruman and Sauron already, and Saruman trying to set up on his own, and it's also in the larger political plans of Saruman, or of Sauron, in him setting himself up back in Mordor again. So those are kind of the dynamics of the thing that we're given, and that's what we have to work with when we then think about how exactly are they going to be treating this in the films. Now, we do have a little bit more to work with than that, in the sense that we do have these glimpses in the trailer which have given us a little bit of insight into what Peter Jackson is possibly thinking about and how he might be handling some of these things. At least we get the Gandalf and Galadriel moment. We get the, you know, some more conversations with grumpy Elrond moments. Like we got in the Lord of the Rings. And so basically that's sort of where we start off from in thinking about what kind of story are they going to make of this in the film, do we think? And then based on that, what do we think that they're going to be actually doing with it? And how do we think they're going to be moving forward and shaping it within the two films? Did I miss anything, Dave? Do you think that have I blanked on any pieces of data that you can remember that I?
Nothing off the top of my head. That's about okay. All we know. It's not much. And also, I want to welcome on the air our special guest for today, Father Roderick from SQPN and the SQPN Secrets of the Hobbit podcast, Secrets of Middle Earth podcast, and Secrets of many other podcasts and The Break. he's like a very, very accomplished podcaster, and I have no idea how he has time to do all this stuff. Good morning, or I guess good afternoon to you, Father.
Hello, Corey. Hello, Dave. Thanks for having me today. It's going to be so much fun to speculate about this whole White Council stuff in the Hobbit movies.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us, Father Roderick. It's always fun talking with you guys. You know, you are a much more experienced movie speculator than I am. So I am very interested to hear what you have to say about this.
That's right.
Well, I mean, I guess where I would sort of start this speculation process is that it seems to me likeliest I kind of like to think about this sort of big picture first and then working down. So to me, the big question is, you know, as I mentioned in the revision process, although the actual conflict got barely a sentence in The Hobbit itself, the actual conflict between the White Council and the Necromancer. Nevertheless, what that sentence implies was that there was a big conflict and the good guys won. And as I said, in the revisions, it actually seems that Tolkien kind of backs down from that a little bit or minimizes the actual conflict, that really it was just a kind of a cover and nothing was actually accomplished and not too much actually happened in that conflict. I have to admit that I sort of start my own film speculation on this subject from the premise that Peter Jackson is not going to go in that same direction, that he is going to build up rather than build down the conflict between the White Council and Dol Guldur. Does that seem a safe premise?
Absolutely. And I think another thing that Peter Jackson definitely wants to do is to these two movies are chronologically the first time that we are introduced to the character of Saruman. And so I'm pretty certain that he has to kind of prelude on what's going to happen in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. We need to see something, learn a bit more about Saruman and why in Gandalf has perhaps mixed feelings. We certainly know that Galadriel has mixed feelings about Saruman. And yes. So I can totally see him expanding on that and show the dynamics, the internal dynamics between Gandalf, between Galadriel, Saruman, and perhaps even some other council members that we don't know about.
Radagast especially, I mean, he's clearly going to be involved, which brings in a complete wild card as we know so little about Radagast. So where is he going to be? I mean, I guess the only moment that we do get of Radagast in the books is the recounted encounter between Gandalf and Radagast when Radagast is sent on Saruman's message, to deliver his message to Gandalf. Though that alone is actually, for the sake of this question, fairly revealing if Jackson's going to follow the book there, because honest Radagast could never possibly be brought to take part willingly in treachery, Gandalf says. And so therefore Saruman had to deceive him in order to get him to participate in the trap that he's laying for Gandalf. So that tells us already sort of some things about Radagast as Tolkien conceived him and how he could be expected to act in this kind of a political situation. And it'll be interesting to see if Jackson follows up on that.
I'm pretty sure, though, that we will not get definitive proof for the fact that Saruman is a traitor. Mm-hmm. I think that they might allude to it and they might hint at the fact that there is a bit of a shadow in this person. But I think they would actually probably spoil the people that are going to watch this in the future in chronological order, not having read the books. You want to keep that actually kind of in the middle, whether or not he is working for Sauron or trying to get – well, we might see a little bit of his attempts to get hold of the ring, but I would keep that really vague.
I am really curious to see that because the Saruman that we see in the Peter Jackson films is kind of a creep.
right.
There's never a point from the very moment he appears on screen. Something seems odd about him. And actually, I guess that's true of Lord of the Rings in general. All the scenes that we see of him, he's pretty clearly something creepy about him. So I'll be interested to see how Christopher Lee plays him in a non-creepy fashion.
Right. Or does he go for non-creepy at all? Yeah.
Maybe he'll just be creepy and...
Right, exactly, but sort of more vaguely and uncertainly. Because, of course, you can be creepy in a, like, I am ominous and wizardly kind of sense, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm evil. Maybe, you know, I mean, I guess I could see that. But actually, you know, the thing that I wonder, though, is whether we would get Father Roderick, you bring up a really interesting question, which I hadn't considered. That is the idea.
He's always doing that.
Yes, exactly. That idea of chronology that you do, of sort of future chronology, that I had not been considering at all, that I admit to have been thinking about this almost entirely from a post Lord of the Rings films lens, and kind of taking that sort of for granted. And it's interesting. I wonder if they would be thinking about it in that way, setting the film up so that it could be watched in chronological order prior to the Lord of the Rings by people who will come to it for the first time 10 years from now. Possibly.
I'm thinking the actual confrontation between Gandalf and Saruman in The Lord of the Rings is quite abrupt. I mean, he goes to talk to Saruman, and before you know it, they're fighting. So I could imagine that in The Hobbit, he will take, since he has more time to elaborate, that we will see, for instance, a certain transition in the way that Saruman behaves. And so I can imagine that in the first movie, we will see the more benevolent side of him, the kind of grandfatherly, you know, gentle, looks just like Gandalf, but is slightly different. And then that towards the, in the second movie, towards the end, we will actually get to see much more of the darker side of him. And then we get to guess that there's something fishy about this man. And I think that Galadriel is going to play an important role in conveying that the concern or to, that she has some kind of a presentiment that there's something off with Gandalf, with Saruman.
Is that because of the statements in the book, Father? Because where is it, Corey? I can't remember
Galadriel herself said that if she had had her way, the White Council would have been led by Gandalf instead of Saruman.
Yes.
Saruman also says when he meets Galadriel with Gandalf and Elrond at the end, as they're traveling, you know, after the war is over and they're traveling back up north and they pass Wormtongue and Saruman on the road, he says that, he says of Galadriel, she always hated me and schemed for your part. There's clear distrust.
Galadriel always struck Galadriel me as a schemer.
what if Galadriel is first very skeptical, talks about it with Gandalf, perhaps even in that famous scene that we see in the trailer. And then Gandalf not being convinced and not seeing that darker side at first. Because after all, why would he go and see Saruman in The Lord of the Rings if he were already convinced that you couldn't trust him?
Right. And I have to admit that that's one of the things that it's one of the moments that I've always liked least in the films is how they contrived by the removal of Radagast. Which I thought made Gandalf's decision to go to Saruman utterly and indefensibly illogical in the films. Yes. You know, like, here's like, okay, the Nazgul could be here at any minute. We must take the ring to safety. Here's the best plan. You two run off by yourselves, and I'm going to ride hundreds of miles in the opposite direction just on the vague suspicion that perhaps Saruman will be able to help me. I mean, it just is absolutely makes no sense of any kind. In the book, when he is further removed from Frodo, he doesn't know how close the Nazgul are, and he's been urgently summoned by Saruman so that he actually believes that he has positive reason to think, that it would be advantageous for him to go to Saruman right away. And he also has reason to believe that there's plenty of time, for him to be able to do that and still come back. It makes a certain amount of sense in the book, and it just makes none in the films. But I agree.
Salvage that by showing us in the second movie, for instance, how Saruman, after his initial reluctance to go to Dol Guldur and to do anything about the situation, to still join the other wizards in casting out the necromancer, thereby gaining the trust of Gandalf.
Well, right. It is. They do say in the Council of Elrond that it was largely by the devices of Saruman that they managed to quote unquote drive out the necromancer. Now, of course, right. We know that the necromancer, you know, fainted that loss, but still, I actually think when we get into the discussion about how that confrontation is going to be portrayed, it's going to be interesting because we know that Saruman's supposed to be instrumental. So to the extent that there will be a battle, it's going to be kind of a Saruman-Sauron battle. So he's actually going to be the heroic character in that.
Yeah. Well, and then I can totally see some kind of a discussion between or even at the end of the battle, if Galadriel is there and Gandalf turns towards Galadriel and says, you see?
He's right, exactly, right, right. But see, you know, that's a fine line to walk because, like, do you want to end the second Hobbit film with making Gandalf look like an idiot and everybody in the audience knowing, you know, like have the last image of Gandalf be like, oh, come on, because everybody already knows he's a crook. That could backfire, but I could totally see that. I mean, I agree. One of the things that really has to happen is that he has to maintain Saruman's appearance of goodness to the other characters. But what is to me an interesting question is, to what extent is he going to reveal it to the audience? That is, in a size, or are we even going to see? Is he going to have the Palantir tuned in to Sauron yet? Is one question that I ask. And if he does, are we actually going – because that would be, I think, one way to play it, and even a very logical way to play it. I don't think this is what Tolkien was suggesting in the books, but I could easily see it happening in the films, where the whole – you know, basically that the entire battle could end up being like a two-man con, basically, where, you know, Saruman saying, I'm going to pretend to fight you, and Sauron saying, I will pretend to flee.
Oh.
You know, so that they could actually have contrived it, and Jackson could show us the two of them contriving it and have nobody else suspect, so that the tension is really invested in the dramatic irony, you know, how much more the audience knows than the characters.
Although I think in terms of protecting the audience that is going to watch this in chronological order for and not spoiling the big reveal that Saruman is actually a bad guy, I think it's just this the moment that he lifts the cloth from the Palantir in Lord of the Rings, that would lose its entire power if you have already shown that in The Hobbit. Mm-hmm.
I would go for a very subtle way.
I would just imply that everything he says can be interpreted in two ways, and he might be scheming and he might not be, you know.
Right.
So I think that Peter Jackson has to make it believable that Gandalf puts his trust in Saruman. And I think that is largely going to happen during the battle, where, you know, even though Galadriel had her doubts, we will see that Saruman is actually helping to get rid of the necromancer. And then later on, we will conclude that it's probably all been some kind of a, you know, something that they schemed in.
Kabuki theater.
Right. Though I do think it's. It is certainly within, I think, the scope of I still think it would be sufficiently true to the Tolkien story to have Saruman be genuinely fighting against Saruman genuinely fighting against Sauron here. I think that could really I don't think that two of them have to be in alliance yet. So it might be that they actually do that you know maybe at the end of the movie we have a hint of his going to use the Palantir for the first time or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, we see his decision, you know, so that we can see him. He's already gone off on a kind of a questionable road. That is, he's playing his own game independent of the council, but he's not allied with Sauron, and he's not obviously and manifestly evil yet. But we see the sort of the hint of, you know, he's going there. He's walking in that direction. And, you know, the next time we see him, he will have, you know, his direct connection to Mordor set up.
So we have no precise notion of when it is that Saruman goes bad in the timeline of Middle-earth, do we?
I'm trying to remember exactly.
This is what they're asking in the chat room, and they generally agree that we really have no idea.
No, because I'm afraid there might be something that I'm overlooking or forgetting, but I don't think so.
The internet will correct you.
We don't know when he looks in the Palantir exactly. Because I'm trying to remember the comments that Gandalf makes about there and the comments in the no, it's not the appendices. It's in Unfinished Tales.
I mean, what he says basically that I recall is just it's a statement on the wisdom of studying too closely the arts of the enemy. But we know that Saruman was doing that for a long time, and initially not not maliciously, but rather with the best of intentions. So.
Well, it could be interesting to see that now that Saruman is the leader of the White Council, we could see some moments where he actually reveals to Galadriel and Gandalf and Radagast that, you know, he has a certain fascination for Sauron.
Right. So I've been reading Sauron's diary here.
Fascinations because he wants to defeat him, but at the same time, there's a growing kind of almost like osmosis happening there where he's just by studying Sauron and being fascinated, you can tell that there's a little bit of a temptation there to consider Sauron not just as an enemy, but almost like an enemy you'd like to emulate because you want to be as powerful as Sauron.
Yeah, now, of course, there are two things. There are two factors to remember. That is, the time of his looking in the Palantir and the time of his being ensnared by Sauron are not the same. He said, okay, here's I was just quickly flipping to the passage in the Two Towers where Gandalf is commenting on Sauron's usage of the Palantir. And he says, okay, now it appears that as the Rock of Orthanc has withstood the storms of time, so there the Palantir of that tower has remained. But alone it could do nothing but see small images of things far off and days remote. Very useful, no doubt, that was to Saruman. Yet it seems that he was not content. Further and further abroad he gazed until he cast his gaze upon Barad-dûr. Then he was caught. So there you see is the answer. Cast his gaze upon Barad-dûr in Mordor, post-kicking of the necromancer out of Dol Guldur. So that's pretty definitive, actually, that he did not establish his semi-allegiance to Mordor until after Sauron had left Mirkwood and set up again in Mordor. But it's also equally clear from that passage that Saruman had been using the Palantir already. So I think that just as you guys were just talking about, the two different factors involved in here, the sort of stages of temptation or stages of corruption in Saruman, are first his desire for his own power, his studying the works of Sauron and his studying of the Rings of Power, his desire to make a Ring of Power of his own, his setting up for himself in Orthanc, his using the Palantir on his own to gain more knowledge and wisdom and power for himself. That's one thing which is leading him down, which is presenting him with temptations, which he is systematic, which is seems to be increasingly giving into. But then his being ensnared by the will of Sauron directly through the instrument of the Palantir. And then his being ensnared and dominated by Sauron himself. So that's sort of then the final stage when he actually is sort of like officially and completely evil, whereas he was just kind of on the path to the dark side prior to that. So if that is indeed how they play it, then basically, Tolkien says pretty clearly that Saruman and Sauron are not in league together at the time of Sauron's being kicked out of Mirkwood. But anyway, so but you know, will they do it that way? Will they? I mean, the Palantir. He would have been using the Palantir in secret, unbeknownst to any of the other of the White Council. He would have been using the Palantir for his own benefit, but not yet have been ensnared by Sauron, who might not even have his own Palantir yet, because it's the Ithilstone, which he might not get until he goes back to Mordor.
Oh, you mean Sauron doesn't have
it? Sauron might not have it yet. Yeah. Yeah,
or at least he's. I mean, he obviously is sort of his organization is in possession of it, but
yes.
Maybe he's not. He's not actively using it at the moment.
Yes, it might be. I mean, it's that's not very definitive, but yeah.
So that's interesting. So that seems to shoot a hole in the idea that the battle that the White Council the Dol Guldur confrontation will be portrayed as a collaborative ruse on behalf of Sauron and Saruman, because they're still at odds at this point, which is great from my standpoint, because in my, you know, I never liked the portrayal of Saruman as in Sauron's employ.
Right.
Although I wonder if that introduces a potential sort of conflict for the filmmakers in terms of the non-book audience, the people who are going to be confused that Saruman is fighting against Sauron. Wait, I thought he was working for him.
Well, exactly. And you know, it's basically Peter Jackson has put himself in a position that he now has two completely separate and unrelated groups of purists to deal with, right? He's got the Tolkien purists, as he always did, but he now has the Lord of the Rings film purists who are going to be really upset if there is any inconsistency between the Hobbit film and the Lord of the Rings films. So yeah, he does have to keep both of those things in mind. Now I think that that is certainly a navigable difficulty. You know, that he can basically he can make the Saruman character arc in the Hobbit films to be a kind of like journey to the dark side kind of character arc, basically, where we could possibly see a genuinely good Saruman falling into temptation and being corrupted. That's one way I think it could be played. And then sort of setting us up for seeing him as, you know, in the place where he is with the Palantir and build me an army worthy of Mordor, which I agree, that always bothered me too, because he is in rivalry and not yet in service of Mordor, when he's building his own army. It's not Sauron's idea that he builds an army in the books. So yeah, I mean, as I said, I do think that there are ways that can be done and done pretty well in the films, but it certainly is going to be an interesting and delicate question.
Yes, I've got this strong feeling that at least in the first movie, if we see Saruman, I think we will. He'll be introduced as mostly a gentle wizard, and we will see his friendly side. There is, by the way, a little bit of a, I'm not sure if it's proof, but there is an indication in, I think, the third production video where we see this little glimpse of what they were filming in the UK at the time with the scenes of Saruman. And there's this one phrase where Saruman says, "Who is this odd little fellow?" And you're made to believe that he's talking about Peter Jackson. But what if that's a line of the movie, actually? And it has to do with the way that they will introduce him. And so, you know, could he be talking about Bilbo?
Saruman meeting Bilbo, that's a little wild.
Well, I'm not so sure. I have a theory about that, but we'll get to that later on.
Okay. So do you think that like the White Council is like secretly meeting in the private boardroom next door when Bilbo and the dwarves are at Rivendell?
Well, I'm thinking, but I'm not sure if we're already ready to go into the details of how this whole story can take place. But let's say I can imagine that the story goes like this. Okay. We see the arrival of Bill, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I might be overlooking certain details. But we see Bilbo arrive with the company at Rivendell, and what if we know that there's a conversation between Galadriel and Gandalf in Rivendell? I assume that is going to be in the first movie because they've shown it in the trailer. Mm-hmm. Galadriel seems to be worried. You know, there seems to be a lot of tension in that conversation or worry. So what if that conversation is actually, among other things, about the concerns that Galadriel has about the role of Saruman or whatever the White Council is supposed to do, perhaps worries about what's going on in Dol Guldur. And what if this conversation takes place while the company is there and for some reason Saruman is there too or arrives in Rivendell and they talk with Elrond, speaking of convening with the White Council because of the things they heard about Dol Guldur. And so what if Saruman in Rivendell is introduced to Bilbo? He says who is this odd little fellow line? And seems to be very benevolent, etc. And then Gandalf is sent off to go to, it's in Rivendell that they decide to take, to organize a meeting with the White Council. But then Gandalf cannot immediately do that because he has to accompany the company to the edge of Mirkwood first And then we'll go to south to have the actual meeting. So in that way, I think that you would you would make the mistake of having the White Council do their meeting in Rivendell itself, although technically that is south of Mirkwood, more or less. But it could introduce Saruman to Bilbo, which I think would be interesting.
That would be interesting. I mean, it's true. I mean, there are many difficulties that are going to be, and this is one of the kinds of things that I think is, you know, sort of speaking to Tolkien purists for a second. It's one of the things which is going to introduce a large number of changes to the story, because there are things that Tolkien himself didn't work out. And you know that if Tolkien himself had rewritten The Hobbit as he set out to do, he would have made some changes like this too. Because if you are raising, remember, he was not only in retrospect, you know, in his retconning of his story later on, he was not only increasing the significance overall of that he was decreasing the actual conflict, but increasing the significance of Gandalf's business in the South, that it became part of the overall move of Sauron's working into power in the Third Age. But at the same time, he's also increasing the significance of the quest for Erebor. And that happens very early, of course, in Appendix A, when, you know, with that theoretical conversation between Gandalf and Gimli and Frodo, when Gandalf is telling the true story of the Hobbit and the backstory and everything. And there it's very clear that this is, you know, what was in the 1937 Hobbit a treasure hunt by the dwarves, a desire to go back and get their treasure back from the dragon who stole it, which is really a fairly private affair. By the end of the book, it's become a bigger thing. And once we get to Lake Town, it becomes into this, like, the restoration of the life of a region and everything. But even there, it's only of regional importance. We're not given the sense, because I don't think Tolkien himself had the sense, that this story was really, like, a huge pivotal story in the history of the Third Age of Middle-earth. Of course, the Third Age of Middle-earth didn't exist when he was writing The Hobbit in 1937. So when he places it within that history later on, he gives it a real prominence and shows that Gandalf, at least, even if the others are not, Gandalf is very concerned about Smaug and how he could be used by Sauron, who is clearly growing in power, and he's got to do something about that. So in other words, the quest of Bilbo and the dwarves becomes, in this sense, a big deal, is seen as a big deal by the wise. And if that's the case, then we have, Father Roderick, as you were suggesting, a real conflict on Gandalf's part, where he's got a big job to do with the White Council, which is bigger than it was in the 1937 book, but he's also got to accompany Bilbo and the dwarves, which is more of a big deal than it was in the 1937 book, but actually makes it harder to justify his leaving them on the edge of Mirkwood, because then basically Gandalf's departure in the book becomes, in retrospect, like the Gandalf's departure from Frodo in the films. That is where he's like, well, I've taken you on this important quest and you're right now on the edge of the most dangerous bit. So bye. I'm just going to leave you for no reason. I'm even going to tell you, I'm just like, have a good time in Mirkwood. Now again, like that happens in the book and it's fine in the books because again, it's clear that Gandalf, like his involvement in this quest is a minor deal. Like the whole thing is a minor deal. Important to them, to the dwarves, but Gandalf seems to be kind of, if anything, in it for the treasure in the 1937 Hobbit. Because he is owed a share of their dragon treasure, as he says. But anyway, I mean, whereas again, now when from beginning to end, we have Gandalf and Elrond and Galadriel and Saruman, presumably, acting as, you know, the caretakers of the future destiny of Middle-earth and taking action in these circumstances, which are clearly concerning and have these big long-term ramifications, it puts both parts of the story in a very different position and therefore Gandalf in a really tricky place.
So I'm looking at the time, and I think we should start transitioning toward
We probably should.
Yeah, toward the confrontation between the White Council and Sauron, because that's what our prediction question will turn on. So let's talk a little bit about And since we're you know the theme of these two episodes is the split, let's talk a little bit about how we envision the battle, if there is a battle at all, how that's going to happen, and of course that's what our prediction will be about eventually, and then maybe what the impact that has on the time and chronology of the film. So, you know, in other words, last week, Father Corey and I talked a lot about, or started to get into, if this is a huge battle, where are they going to stick it in these two films? It wouldn't really fit at the beginning of the second film. You wouldn't want to risk having it, you know, having two battles in one film and having it sort of upstage the Battle of Five Armies. But then does it make sense at the end of the first film? And we started to see that at one point we were like, boy, they just need to make three movies instead of two. There's too much content. So how do you guys think the battle is going to happen? If a battle at all. I suspect, Corey, from having seen what you wrote in the question, I get the impression that you're heading in the direction of no battle.
Well,
or
I'm
conflated
heading
into battles.
Oh, well, and that, of course, that of course is the really sobering possibility. And I might as well just out with this right away. That is, you know, I've been thinking about this, but avoiding talking about it for weeks, mostly because I've been trying to avoid thinking about it. And that is the idea that they will actually conflate these things, the conflict between the White Council and the Necromancer and the Battle of Five Armies, that they will bring those two things together in some sense. And that idea seems to me a little bit odd. But the main sort of strength of this argument, or the fuel for this particular speculation, comes from those comments that Benedict Cumberpatch made. And Dave, you probably remember those better than I do.
He was just talking about something about the Necromancer and the Battle of Five Legions or something like
right,
that.
Right, yeah, he didn't get the name right.
Yeah, and people and so the internet immediately responded by saying, Benedict Cumberbatch, who, you know, in his ignorance of the story of The Hobbit, has inadvertently revealed that Sauron will be at the Battle of Five Armies. That was the general sort of outcry from the internet.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I mean, on the one hand, I guess, my first reaction was, no, they wouldn't do that. But then the more I think about it is that it would be a way out for them in exactly the way that you are describing, Dave. That is the problem of multiple battles. If the more of them you conflate, then the more eggs you can put in one basket, and the less time you have to spend doing that, and the less distraction that there is. I can imagine this. Again, I find the idea distasteful, highly distasteful. But in the end, I don't really think it's going to happen. I would predict against it. That's not exactly what we're predicting today. But if I were asked yes or no, I would say no. I don't think they're going to conflate those two. But I guess, you know, the real question comes down to what is going to be the nature of the conflict. How do we see? And this is one of the challenges. This has always been one of the challenges. And we can talk about some of the ways in which Peter Jackson responded to this challenge in the films, because I think we can see some patterns there. But the challenge that I'm referring to is, how do you represent magic as Tolkien depicts it in his world? Because very rarely is magic depicted as an outward thing. I mean, the conflict between, one of the pieces of evidence that I think is sort of most obvious, and where Peter Jackson takes a very kind of simplistic approach to dealing with this, is the confrontation between Gandalf and Saruman at Orthanc, which was cut out from the theatrical version of the film. And I'm alluding in particular to the scene when Saruman, like, chucks a fireball at him.
Mm-hmm.
in the movie, right?
Yeah.
And that's of course exactly what doesn't happen in the book. Like that is the perfect illustration of what doesn't happen in the book. There is indeed a magical confrontation. There is a confrontation of will between Gandalf and Saruman, and Gandalf wins. But it's utterly invisible. It's not inaudible. We hear them talking back and forth, but there are no fireballs thrown. That's just not how Tolkien's magic works. There are very few examples of fireball throwing magic in Tolkien's world. And the greatest confrontations of magical power are done, the very biggest are done through song, but wouldn't that be kind of awesome? But I don't expect that to happen either. You know, there to be a big choral sing off between
like The Voice.
It would be awesome, actually.
Guest spot by CeeLo Green.
No, it would be like, you know, two choirs on either side. You know, it'd be more like the Battle of the Bands, except very different.
Two bands.
Anyway. Yeah, exactly.
I think that Peter Jackson has established kind of his vocabulary in translating that to the big screen. And you know, for modern movie audiences, you probably need that. It's kind of the way that we tell things like this.
Yeah. No, I mean, exactly. I mean, I was expecting that. And I thought the fireball was a little bit silly, but it does establish what's going on there. And you need to establish it visually. You know, you can't, because you can't get on a film what Tolkien does in the book, which is to describe what everyone was thinking and feeling, you know, while they, two of them were talking to each other and the images that were raised in their minds. I mean, there's no way to convey that on film. So, okay, you chuck a fireball. The other big example that comes immediately to mind, of course, is the exorcism of Denethor. Denethor was under a spell,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't like that, and his cleansing is not like it was done on screen. But I didn't, you know, when I saw the film, I didn't really, I was a little bit surprised by the way it went down, I thought that was fun. Again, it was clearly, a way for them to dramatically help people to visualize the conflict that was actually happening. And there was a conflict of wills there. It was Wormtongue and Gandalf primarily, and not Saruman directly. But anyway, it was fine. I mean, again, as you say, we can see him establish a kind of vocabulary for how that sort of thing is translated. And this therefore leads then to the bigger question of that conflict. When the White Council drives the necromancer out of Mirkwood, I think if Tolkien had depicted that conflict, I don't think there would have been anything to see, basically. I mean, I think like we would have had them like sitting around in a room and the necromancer sitting in another room and like him leaving. I mean, just like it would not, I don't think it would have been much to watch.
You know, I think in terms of the potential for visualizing this is huge. And I think Peter Jackson would be crazy not to depict this battle because again, it will show us for the first time, if he chooses to depict this, and if he does, I think it's going to be in the second movie. It will basically allow him to show Gandalf, Galadriel, perhaps even Elrond. I don't know exactly who is going to go there down to Dol Guldur,
yes.
But to show how powerful these characters are and what they can do. Plus, there might be different ways to, I don't know, manipulate the wind or animals or whatever is out there to defeat, or at least seemingly defeat, Sauron, with joint forces. I think symbolically that would be really interesting. Visually, it would be very, very, would just be, I think, almost like a wizard, kind of a wizard version of the Justice League or the
right.
Avengers,
right.
You know?
Right, exactly.
All these wizards have a certain, you know, you've got the brown wizard, the gray wizard, the white wizard. Well, could that translate to the way in which they fight?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, certainly with Radagast, there's a lot of potential. I mean, you can see, I mean, obviously there are going to be, Radagast's, animal and bird allies coming in to fight and like
yes.
that one would expect, right? I mean, there's certainly a lot of potential for that to be very cool on film.
Well, it could make it would make for such a nice dramatic development where in the first movie we'll kind of bit by bit start to discover what's going on in Dol Guldur, and we will see Gandalf going there and seeing the fears of the White Council confirmed, and then he gets back to the White Council. You've got this kind of debate going on, and for some reason Saruman doesn't really want to act, and then at one point in the second movie they realize that they have to do something, and so they all go down there. I can imagine that filmically you want to have a big kind of concluding battle at the end of the movie, especially because the return to the Shire is kind of really simple and not very spectacular. So you need a high point, I think, in the second movie. So what if we will see a crescendo of both, you know, what's happening with the Battle of the Five Armies, and then at the same time, perhaps even intercut what's happening in Guldur with the White Council and Sauron, and then the conclusion of the Hobbit movies might be, before of course we return to the Shire, is that, well, hey, they chased Sauron and we know that Saruman is now a good guy, and so but we've also seen how terribly dangerous the Necromancer is, that he is Sauron. That's going to be another reveal. And so when we return to all these characters in the trilogy, we will have much more backstory and therefore much more, I don't know, admiration or anticipation as to, you know, what they're capable of.
Yeah. No, I do agree that we're going to get some kind of conflict. I mean, I do think that I cannot imagine him passing up that opportunity. And the number one reason that I disbelieve in the conflation, the simple conflation of the struggle with the Necromancer and the Battle of Dol Guldur, is that I think that the character of those battles is going to be so different.
Yes.
As you say, you know, like the full out, you know, wizard and elf queen battle. The whole tenor of that, I think, is going to be very different, and enables him to explore the same kind of battle and good versus evil dynamics in a completely different visual environment and in a completely different. I think it actually gives him opportunities that he wouldn't be able to resist and shouldn't resist.
Well, and intercutting this or intercutting the two battles could also help the movie, because if you're just watching this massive Battle of the Five Armies, you tend to kind of get bored after a while. You can only see that for so many minutes. But if at the same time something else is happening on a deeper level, or, you know, on the wizard level, I think it would help tell the story of both these battles if you can kind of alternate between the two.
So does this mean are we heading in the direction of thinking that the confrontation between the White Council and Sauron will happen at the end of the second film during the Battle of Five Armies?
I wonder if there's any proof in what Tolkien writes that could invalidate that.
Well, the number one thing is Gandalf. Gandalf is at the Battle of Five Armies. So course, it's possible that he's not involved in the attack on Dol Guldur. And I mean, like, basically, you have to either have Gandalf involved in both, and he's like commuting, or you've got to, you know, like, I'm late for my next cataclysmic battle. I've got to run. but at the same time, there would be a significant cost in not having him be there too. So that's the one thing, and it's hard for me to imagine Gandalf not being at the Battle of Five Armies.
And what if they, in order to solve this, they would move the battle in Dol Guldur to, let's say, the kind of halfway through the movie? So you get these two story arcs where the first part just ends with culminates in the wizard battle at Dol Guldur, and then, you know, the second half of the movie, the high point is going to be that Battle of the Five Armies.
So I mean, I think that's an interesting point, because I think it's worth pointing out, just to remind ourselves, that if they stuck to the strict chronology of the books, the battle at Dol Guldur would be happening at the end of the first film, because by the time that they arrive in Esgaroth, in Lake Town, They have this there's this right at the beginning of the chapter of that in the book. They have this little brief paragraph where they talk about Gandalf and about how he's on his way, that he's done his business with the necromancers and he's on his way. Yeah.
Wow. That could actually indicate that we're going to see it in the first movie.
Yeah. That's what I'm wondering. And I'm wondering it seems like if we go sort of on the assumption that the simplest thing to do would be to do it the way it is in the book, and that changing it's hard, so why wouldn't they just put it in the first film? The one concern I would have with that is will people find it anticlimactic if the White Council storyline is over by the end of the first film, and there's no more White Council storyline, and won't people be like, but wait, that's the real bad guy?
Well, and in particular, since, as we were talking about last time, if they do in fact do the split post barrel ride, then good. And we were talking that leaves an enormous amount of Hobbit journey plot for the first film. So to say we're going to do that and like at least 90% of the White Council plot in the first film, I mean, the idea of them doing that much of the Hobbit story, going all the way basically through the end of chapter 9 of the book in the first film, that by itself to me almost suggests that we're going to see the bulk of the White Council stuff in the second film. And the stuff in the trailer could be taken to support that idea, since we only get a couple glimpses of White Council stuff, nothing cataclysmic, and all of it seeming to be preparatory. That is, like, as you know, Father Roderick, as you were saying, like worried conversations.
Well, and that would be, I think, dramatically much more interesting to kind of build it up in the first movie, where we start to realize, oh, wait a minute, there's something else going on. And it's not just a dragon. And I think one way to solve this, of course, is via the very simple narrative device of a flashback, where Gandalf, and that's actually how it works in Tolkien. It's we hear afterwards, it kind of in the last chapter, that well, Gandalf was doing this fight against the necromancer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I could see that. Do that.
Possibly. Though I'm laughing at the prospect of thinking of if they were to do it, how silly it would look on film if they did it exactly the same way. We have the Battle of Five Armies. Everything is fine. We're riding back to the Shire. And oh, by the way, another climactic battle and flashback. Like that would be really silly. But yeah, maybe, I mean, it's a little hard for me to see if as the trailer seems to me to suggest, they're really going to be doing the White Council stuff as an alternate story. If they're going to be cutting back and forth from White Council stuff to dwarf and hobbit journey stuff, in a way which is anyway similar to how they were cutting back and forth between, you know, Mordor and Gondor in The Lord of the Rings. If they are going to handle the two stories like that in the films, then I would not think that they could do the battle in flashback form. It would have to be at least parallel, if not simultaneous, or even, as we were saying, even potentially conflated. That would be, because of course that's the other way. That's the other attraction to the conflation thing. As much disincentive as there is in other ways, that's the simplest way to get Gandalf in both places at the same time, is to make them both happen at the same place.
I think that they respect Tolkien too much to do that, because it would really change something that Tolkien himself described. I mean, it's different from taking use of the vagueness in as to, you know, the chronology of certain events, and then kind of fill it in the movie. But then this would really change the timeline, and I don't know if they want to go there. I'd be upset, especially because there must be other ways to do this. But I do agree that we know from the trailer that Gandalf will go to Dol Guldur, so we have lots of Dol Guldur stuff already happening there, with, you know, the Gandalf almost acting as a detective, trying to figure out what's going on, and a bit by bit. So he has to return to the White Council and report. We need to see that struggle between him and Saruman and Galadriel. So yeah, adding a battle to that, it would be too much. It would be overcharging the first movie.
I do think it would. I think that
start the second movie with the battle. And do it straight away, you know, instead of us, we leave the company with their arrival in Lake Town, or just before their arrival in Lake Town.
Yeah.
And the second movie starts with this epic battle that immediately wakes us up and acts almost like the James Bond action scene device. You
right,
know?
Right.
What's happening? And then we cut back to the company.
You know, I love that idea. And that would leave Gandalf plenty of time. If they're just arriving at Lake Town, then, you know, it would be the easiest thing in the world to protract their stay at Lake Town a little bit, or at least by implication protract it. And then there's still all the time of them going up and being on the mountain, and then Smaug is dead, and then the armies are in the field, and then it's 2 weeks later. So, I mean, there's plenty of time, especially since Gandalf can apparently, as we saw in the Fellowship of the Ring film, travel enormous distances in almost no time. You know, like he pops off to Gondor for the weekend, for instance, to do a little light research. And anyway, so that's I think getting Gandalf up north after an early in the film or opening of the film battle would be trivial. So yeah, no, that I think could work, especially since that's so packed. I mean, the time of Bilbo and the dwarves in Lake Town and on the mountain and with Smaug and the battle with Smaug, that would be so much film time that Gandalf showing up would not at all seem sudden.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I mean that I think is very appealing. But we should probably get to our actual prediction now, as I'm swiftly running out of time. Yes. But
I think this conversation is nicely segueing us into it, because I certainly am feeling looking at our choices now, I'm not so sure I'm feeling inevitably pulled toward one, but I'm thinking that we're going to get something that's going to minimize screen time. I don't think we're going to get a 45 okay. minute. I don't
right.
think we're
so
going to.
This is not going to be. We're going to start the film with the Battle of Helm's Deep and then end with the Battle of Five Armies, basically.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I don't think we're going to start the film with a 45 minute battle and the movie with a 45 minute battle and have like half an hour of dialogue in between with the
right.
dragon,
including Smaug and the death of Smaug. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Wow, that's going to be an action-packed film.
Yeah.
So, okay, so prediction. This regards what will the film adaptation of the conflict between the White Council and the Necromancer be? How is this conflict going to be portrayed on screen in the theatrical edition? Always our disclaimer, on screen in the theatrical edition. I'm sure there's plenty of opportunity to film like 2 hours worth of content and stick it into the special features, but what's going to make it to the theaters? here are our options, which maybe we'll rejigger these a little bit. Option A is immaterial spiritual conflict from a distance. So I'm guessing we're interpreting this not as
like
magic.
Tolkien style, like the way that Tolkien depicts the conflict between Gandalf and Saruman at Orthanc. Like nothing visual happen. Right. This would be like the complete purist. Like, you know, we'll see, I don't know what, the White Council gathering around a table, holding hands and concentrating. And, you know, and we'll go back and forth to like Sauron, who may or may not appear like a fiery eyeball. And, and you know, and then like, you know, something snaps and it goes. So yeah, no light flashes, no fireballs, no troops on the ground, just you know, like one group of people gathering their wills and exerting their wills against another.
Actually, I think the way to explain this one is this is the Mark Fisher answer.
We give Mark such a hard time. It's not quite fair, but
so okay, so there's that. B is epic battle sequence. That's the we'll call that the Battle of the Hornburg, or well, I guess in the film it was Battle of Helm's Deep option.
Yes.
C would be direct physical magical conflict between principals only. So it won't be armies hacking at each other with swords, but rather Saruman shooting fireballs at Sauron and vice versa.
Right.
Similar to the Gandalf-Saruman confrontation in Fellowship. And then option D is no direct conflict at all. So this is like what? They arrive at Dol Guldur and he's gone already?
Yeah, like because you know, I kind of think D a little bit unlikely, but it's a theoretical option basically that
I don't
we
know,
have
man.
The withdrawal.
believe it or not, I'm kind of leaning in that direction of a big buildup and then a deflation when they get there and like, oh, Sauron ran away.
Right, and that's when they discover the truth, so that the dramatic moment could be not a conflict and a victory, but the discovery of the awful truth. This was actually Sauron, and now he's returned to Mordor and is setting himself up and building Barad-dûr again.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep, yep.
So, So those are options to review. How's that, what's the film adaptation of the conflict between the White Council and the Necromancer going to be? Immaterial spiritual conflict from a distance. Option B is Peter Jackson style epic battle. C is Peter Jackson style magical one-on-one conflict. And D is no conflict at all, or at least maybe a lot of buildup. Maybe even an army marching on Dol Guldur, but no actual meeting of two forces.
One sort of caveat or clarification that I would give to option C, that is the direct conflict between principles, direct and sort of visual magical conflict between principles, I would count Radagast animal friends still being in this category.
Yes.
Like if Radagast is there and he summons up like a flock of birds or an army of rats or whatever it does. I don't know. It could be awesome. But anyway, I would consider as part of like Radagast as principle. That would be like the equivalent of Saruman throwing a fireball in my book. It wouldn't count as armies in the field if it's just Radagast's animal friends.
Yes.
That way I would offer that as a sort of amendment or clarification of that category. Radagast's animal friends are an extension of himself. I'm just like 100% convinced we're going to see Radagast's animal friends. I mean, I think there's like almost no chance that that's not going
to
happen.
So I just wanted to add that there's a person in the chat room, Elvish Mouse, who said, "Well, I feel like B is most likely, then C, then A, but part of me wants to see A. D is interesting."
Commit, Elizabeth. Commit. Okay. Well, I have to run to class in about 30 seconds.
So
give my prediction.
I'll get your prediction, and then Father Roderick and I'll close out the episode.
Yeah, we probably should do that. I am going to go with C, the direct clash between principles.
Fireballs and Radagast the Brown's friends.
Yeah, and I like in part here, I think Father Roderick, I'm inspired by your Avengers comparison. I think that the idea of having not at the head of an army, but having the White Council basically show up in person as this kind of Justice League, we're showing up in person to whoop the Necromancer. That's really appealing,
Yeah, and I've got one non-literary argument for this as well, or extra reason why they would do this. Hobbit action figures. I will say no more.
right. That is a decisively non-literary argument for this. I agree. But yes. Yeah. No, exactly. So, of course, if Sauron fields an army against them, but they don't field an army against him, that doesn't count as B. You know, if it's them, you know, like if it's the White Council Justice League showing up and kicking the butt of Sauron and his whole army, it still counts as C. long as there have to be two armies in the field that which are not Radagast's animal friends in order for B to be true.
what if Legolas happens to be there? Does that count as an army?
Yeah, absolutely. If Legolas is there, it's automatically B. I think really without question. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Or Toriel. Either one.
that complicates it for me, but anyway.
Okay, well, I should run, but this was very much fun. We'll definitely have to do this again. Father Roderick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I am very keen to hear what Dave finally commits to. He always waffles about these things, but I'll be very interested to hear what Dave finally commits to, and to hear about your final prediction. I will get briefed on that later, but I should dash off to class now.
All right. Well, have fun, Corey. Father Roderick and I will take it from here.
All right. Thanks very much. Bye, everybody.
Bye. All right. Would you like to go next, Father, or shall I?
Well, let me give it a try. Now that we've been talking and kind of weighing the various options, I'm tending towards a battle at the start of the second movie, mm-hmm. where it will be the main wizards or the members of the White Council going to Dol Guldur, perhaps being surprised by the kind of the for perhaps when they go there, they're not certain what they will uncover there. They are probably going there because of the report that Gandalf gives them after his visit in the first movie. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that we will see much of, you know, how serious the threat is in Dol Guldur. And so that could explain why they won't mount an entire army to go there, because that's something that they will probably just realize when they are on location. They know that something is going on and that the necromancer is involved, but I don't see them, you know, mounting an entire army and march down. And I'm also thinking that because if they would, then I'd almost expect Tolkien to have written a little bit more about it. So that's why I'm thinking it's just going to be the core group. However, that last remark of Corey made me think, the Legolas and Toriel. I wouldn't be surprised if they were actually part of that expedition. And because, of course, we know that Elrond is also part of the White Council, isn't he? At least that's what I think.
Yes, Elrond is a part of the White Council. Elrond, so, Galadriel, the three wizards, and then some other elves whose names escape me and who are not mentioned with any regularity in the books.
Right. So what if Elrond decides to join them in that expedition, and somehow the word gets to the elves in Mirkwood, and Legolas and Tauriel also decide to, you know, help out or accompany Elrond.
To me, it seems highly unlikely that Legolas will not be in that scene.
Especially because we know that his role will be substantial.
Yes.
And we know from Evangeline Lilly, she says that, you know, most of her role is going to be in the second movie, and it's much more demanding than she thought it would be. So I'm thinking demanding, physically demanding, because as an actress, you know, she wouldn't really care much about some extra dialogue.
Yeah.
But if it's a physical role, if it involves fighting, if it involves special effects, if it involves flying through the air on, you know, in all sorts of difficult wires, then, you know, doing the kung fu fighting, that would count for me as being demanding. So I'm thinking of not really an army going there, but I think Elrond and Legolas and Tauriel and perhaps a few other elves, but just a small company, but an extended company, not just the four wizards, but a slightly kind of a small expedition group. And then realizing what's really going on, then this big battle between the necromancer, aka Sauron, and these wizards, kind of X-Men slash Avengers style, that would totally work for me. So, but if it's true that that will automatically make it B, then
I disagree with Corey. I don't think Legolas counts as an army. I think he counts as an Avenger.
Yeah, me too. Or at least like the, you know, the what Robin is to Batman, you know?
Yes. Yeah. He Legolas and Tauriel both, those sort of prominent named characters played by famous actors, they all count as superheroes.
I think so too. And I don't expect a huge army of elves or, you know, or orcs on the other side. I think this is going to be a battle of the superheroes. at least that would make sense, and it would set it apart from what happens at the end of the movie, and you would not get that fatigue of, oh, yet another big battle, because it would leave the Battle of Five Armies to be what it is, which is a big, you know, massive battle scene reminiscent of what we've seen in The Lord of the Rings. And it would still create a very nice, very distinct action moment at the beginning of the second movie to kind of plunge us straight into the overarching, you know, epic story that is being told.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that would make you C, right?
I think C, yes.
Okay.
See, with Legolas and Antorio.
Yeah, I think what we're getting to, I'm modifying the answers a little bit just to say that A is basically that there'll be sort of an insubstantial conflict. B is epic battle sequence. C is the emphasis there is on the fact that on the good side, the only people who show up to fight are the Avengers. and maybe a few additional people. Maybe there's a small band of elves from Lothlorien or something. Right. But basically not an army. Mm-hmm. So okay, C. And I am going to choose D. I think they're going to show up, and I think that they're going to find that Sauron's gone, and there's not going to be a battle.
Huh? And why would you choose that?
Well. In part because I like being contrary.
I guess that's what I guess.
Also just because I think that's sort of a way to resolve the tension between I think that's a way to resolve this tension that we're getting at, which is that they need to build something up. They need it to be dramatic. They really do want to play out and exercise this White Council storyline, but that it's really going to be – it's hard to fit it in terms of time. I think we all seem to agree that there's no room for it in the first film if the split is where we expect it to be. And there's this worry that it could overshadow the later Battle of Five Armies, as well as Smaug, that the main Hobbit storyline could be overshadowed by it. So I think one way to do that is basically have it be kind of almost left unresolved. We build it up. This is a major area of, kind of a major storyline of the first film that this necromancer guy's evil. I'm kind of curious to see. We know that the White Council at this point in the story knows who the necromancer really is. They know that it's actually Sauron. I think we're sort of left to infer that they aren't telling anyone yet, since Gandalf doesn't mention this fact to the dwarves. But I think we know that they know. So I'm curious to see if this will be revealed in the film, or if Peter Jackson's going to make this a reveal to the audience. You know, that he's going to refer to him as the necromancer throughout the story, and then right at the end, either during a battle or if my prediction's right, no battle, that's where they'll say it was Sauron all along. I'm curious to see that. But I think one way that you could handle this and resolve the tension between the desire to build up the storyline and also the time issue and the overshadowing issue is have the battle end up not happening, have Sauron escape and make that a dramatic moment that it's like, oh no, he got away to do evil another day. And one possibility is, if we bring this back to Benedict Cumberbatch's comments, is maybe Sauron will escape and he will escape to the Battle of Five Armies and show up there. So I don't know, but I've decided to go out on a limb and guess D.
That'd be interesting.
No battle at all. No conflict. No confrontation.
By the way, I'm starting to doubt now whether Legolas and Toriel will be part of the expedition to get rid of Sauron. Because
I'm not sure Toriel will be there, but I'm convinced Legolas will be there, just because Toriel, it's clear where she fits into the main Hobbit storyline. I think she's going to be in the dungeons where the dwarves are captured, and so I suspect she'll be a part of the army.
But then her bigger role in the second movie
will be the Battle of Five Armies.
The Battle of Five Armies, yeah. That's
or,
kind of what
or even she could be at key scenes. So like the scene where Bilbo hands the Arkenstone over to the Elven King and Bard, maybe she'll be standing there next to him.
Well, but that hardly counts as a demanding role.
Okay, good point. But yeah, I think Battle of Five Armies could be it. But Legolas, yeah. I think, my feeling is one way to use him in these films without having him overshadow the Hobbit characters is to have him be involved in the White Council storyline more.
But we could see him in Mirkwood as well, while the company is captured, and so he might be teaming up with Toriel for all we know,
yes.
and show up at the end of the battle of Five Armies, because Inge in the chat room makes a good point. Wouldn't be much of a secret council if word arrives in Mirkwood about what they're going to do in Dol Guldur, so. That makes sense, unless there is some kind of a Mirkwood representative part of the White Council, because we know, Tolkien infers that there are more members than he actually names. He doesn't give us the entire list, so there could be a Mirkwood delegate or something. Although, we have no proof.
Yep. Well,
I'm sticking with C.
Good. I'm glad you are. I want everyone to. I'm. Yeah, as Corey will say, I'm a big fan of widespread disagreement and debate.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm hoping Mark Fisher picks A again. Let's double check. Yeah, he has yet to pick anything other than A, so I'm hoping he'll go with, they'll do it true to the book. At least some people will believe that there'll be a Helm's Deep style battle, so cool. All right. Well, I guess probably we should wrap this thing up, but thank you very much for joining us, Father Roderick.
It's totally my pleasure.
We were so excited to have you on when we decided – I mean, actually, when we first set out to do this podcast, we're like, well, obviously we will have to get Father Roderick involved, not just as a to do predictions in the game, but we have to have him on occasion because you're like – I don't know. You're just so insightful on the films. You have a really good intuition about how things will happen, and you seem to have a window into Peter Jackson's mind.
Well, the proof is in the pudding. I might be just completely making this stuff up, and it's totally wrong.
But whenever you state your opinions, we're always like, oh man, that's pretty good.
Boy. Well, I hope it kind of it stimulates the whole thought process around this.
Yep, it definitely does. Very briefly, do you want to tell us where Corey's listeners can find out more about you?
Yeah, well, the both of us, of course, host this almost always weekly show about the Hobbit production, and we do talk about plot elements as well. And people can find that at thehobbit.sqpn.com, so thehobbit.sqpn.com, or you can just look for Secrets of the Hobbit in iTunes, and that will also bring you to that particular podcast series. But I do host a lot of other shows, as you mentioned at the beginning, Secrets of Many Podcasts. Or Secrets of Many Topics, and all that and more can be found at the website of the StarQuest Production Network, which people can find at sqpn.com. So sqpn.com, and if you look for SQPN in the iTunes store, it will give you an overview of all our podcasts. Mm-hmm. And so we've got shows about Harry Potter, about Star Trek, about Middle Earth. We have a show where we walk around in Middle Earth as it is presented to us in the game Lord of the Rings Online. That's a very fun podcast to make as well.
Yep.
And
cool. And I definitely encourage listeners to check out Secrets of the Hobbit. That's a wonderful podcast, and we have a great time, and it's very similar in character to this. If you enjoyed this, you'll definitely enjoy Secrets of the Hobbit. And our Twitter account is it's Hobbit Podcast, right?
Yeah, Hobbit Podcast.
Yeah. So people, when you're tweeting your comments and ideas and predictions and thoughts about The Hobbit, in addition to including Tolkien Prof and also me, include Hobbit Podcast as well, so you can broaden the conversation. I also wanted to point out to Corey's listeners, is in the chat room today, we had a whole bunch of people listening live, and one of them is Alorio, and she's from the Warriors of the Westfold podcast, which airs on Middle Earth Network Radio on Fridays at, I believe, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. If I'm incorrect, please correct me, Olorio. And they also are participating in our prediction game. So that's another good opportunity to go and hear people talk about these questions and predictions and get a different take on things. So definitely want people to check that out as well. Keep an eye on these episodes are going to be released, if you're listening live right now, they'll be released hopefully in the next couple of days, and there'll be a new digest episode out, I hope, over the weekend. Let's see, what else? Any other news? And go and keep an eye on the Mythgard website where, we do the posts about these and join in the conversation there, and also on the Tolkien Professor and Mythgard Facebook pages. So, I guess that's all for today. I hope you enjoyed this special two-part series on the split and today's special extra-long episode with our special guest, Father Roderick. Thank you for joining us, Father Roderick.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And to you, our listeners, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.